Exodus chapter 24 verses 1 to 18, the 26th talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on April 9, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 24, Exodus 24, 1 through 18, accompanies this talk.
We're going to be looking at Exodus chapter 24. This is the last chapter in this section that we've been going through. And in this chapter, God and the people of Israel are going to finalize the agreement that they've been working on the terms of over the last several chapters. And this, to my mind, this is kind of the climax of the book in many respects. And it's this agreement is coming, is being made between the people of Israel and God. And the people of Israel have had, they are not making it with an unknown God. They have quite a history now with him. They have seen him as he raised up. They're in slavery in Egypt. They've been crying out to God for an extended period of time. God has Moses born and preserves more of Moses' life at a time when Hebrew boys are being put to death. Moses is adopted by the Pharaoh's daughter and raised in the Pharaoh's household, given the education of one who would rule Egypt. But then circumstances take Moses out of Egypt into the desert, and he spends the next 40 years with a different kind of education, learning about the wilderness and what life is like in those circumstances. Then after that, so he has 40 years education in Egypt, 40 years education in the wilderness, and then God brings him back to Egypt, and he leads the Israelites out of Egypt. And in order to bring that about, God brings the 10 plagues. And Pharaoh's resistant to letting them out, but at the conclusion of the 10 plagues, and especially the last one in which all of the firstborn of Egypt were put to death, Pharaoh says, okay, you can go. So they leave. But 3 days later, they are up against the Red Sea. They have no place to go. Pharaoh's army is coming after them. And so it looks like they've had it. And God opens up the Red Sea, and the people of Israel go through on dry land. And then God closes in the Red Sea on Pharaoh's army. Then 3 days later, they're in the desert, but they're out of water. The water that they come across is bitter water, and God makes it sweet. Later, they run out of food, and God brings the quail so that they can have meat, and he starts providing them with manna on a daily basis so that they have food that they can eat. And all this time, God's leading them through the desert with a cloud during the day and a pillar of fire by night. All of this is stuff that they could see. This is all stuff that they've experienced. So they're making this agreement not with an unknown God, but with a God who has a track record with them, things that they've all seen. And even going way back before that, God had made promises to Abraham 400 years before they go into before this happens. And God tells Abraham, your descendants are going to go into Israel, into Egypt. They're going to be made slaves, but I am going to bring them out and bring them back to this land. So they have lots of evidence as to who God is. And it's with that God then that they are making this agreement. And as you will recall, what God offered is that he would make them, he said, I will make you a people that is special to me. He said in 19:5-6, he said, now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. God made that offer, and the people responded, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So it's then that God tells them, spend 3 days preparing, washing your clothes and purifying yourselves, and in 3 days we'll talk further. So in 3 days, God comes in a display on the mountain. There's earthquake, there's lightning, there's thunder. God appears and he begins to tell them what the terms of the agreement will be, whereby they will become a holy nation and a nation of priests. And we've gone through what the terms of that agreement are. He starts out with the Ten Commandments and he proclaims that to the people of Israel. Directly, they hear his voice. At the conclusion of his presentation of the Ten Commandments, then they say, this is too scary. Let's do it some other way. I know. We will. You tell it to Moses, and Moses then can tell us the rest of what you have to say. So Moses goes up on the mountain, and God tells him what are the laws, what are the commandments that stipulate what you want us to do. And that concluded in the end of the last chapter. After giving the laws, then God goes through and tells them all the things that he's going to do to prepare the way when they go into the land, how he's going to prepare the people that are there so that the Israelites will be able to defeat them, and how God will help them to defeat those people, and the various ways in which God will bless their efforts. But he concludes it by saying, don't worship other gods. The people in the land worship other gods. You will be tempted to worship other gods, but don't do it. So that's the agreement. Those are the terms of the agreement that God has stipulated. And so now in chapter 24, we have the ceremony whereby this is made official. Chapter 24, the first 8 verses. Then he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come up and come near, nor shall the people come up with them. Then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant, which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." So it begins with God telling Moses, giving Moses instructions. Moses and the elders are to come up on the mountain. And it's on the mountain, is partway up the mountain. It's not all the way up the mountain, but partway up the mountain is where the agreement will be finalized and sealed. The people that are supposed to go with him, it's got Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu. Aaron is Moses' brother. Nadab and Abihu are the sons, are two sons of Aaron. He has other sons, but these are two of his sons. As you'll recall, this is going to become the priestly class. The descendants of Aaron become the priests of Israel. It is interesting that Nadab and Abihu are accompanying Moses to this big dinner that they are having with God to finalize this agreement, because a few chapters later in the Pentateuch, they are both going to be struck with fire and killed because they offer what's called strange fire to other gods. So we've got some two people that are going up on the mountain to make this agreement that are later killed for apostasy. Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70 elders are all supposed to accompany Moses up to this finalizing this agreement. Moses is the only one that will go on up the mountain, and we'll see that later. None of the others, including Aaron, are allowed to go up. At this time, then, Moses tells all of the people of Israel what God had told him in the cloud. God had spoken the Ten Commandments to everyone. But the part that follows, God spoke just to Moses, and now he's reporting that to all of the people. All the words of the Lord, and I have been calling that section the Devarim, and all the ordinance, and that's Mishpatim. So those are the two different categories of laws that were in the last few chapters. So he gives them everything, and the people respond by saying, "All the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do." So then in verse 4, "And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord." So he's putting this into writing. And this that he's putting into the writing is apparently what's later referred to in verse 7 as the Book of the Covenant, which presumably then becomes part of the Book of Exodus as he writes that later. Okay, the next day then, Moses arose early in the morning, and he builds two things. He builds an altar, and he builds 12 pillars. Now, it is not described in here exactly how these are oriented, but one commentator suggested, and I think it's very possible, that the altar was built in one place, and the 12 pillars were built opposite, with room in between, where the terms of the agreement are made and various things are done. The 12 pillars representing the whole people of Israel, and the altar representing God. And this agreement is being made between those two parties. He sent young men of the sons of Israel. And why young men? It doesn't indicate that they're priests. It may be that it's a group of young men are helping him because there's a lot of work to be done here. The construction of these altars, the construction of the pillars, and then all of these offerings, there's a lot of manual labor involved there. And it could be that these are just vigorous young men who can provide that labor on this occasion. What they do is they offer burnt offerings. These are whole burnt offerings. So some animals are placed on the altar as burnt offerings, and a burnt offering is consumed completely by the fire. And that symbolizes that which is given to God, is just wholly given to God. The peace offerings are offerings of peace to God. That is to say, these are offerings that stand as a prayer to God for a relationship between the people and God that will be characterized by peace. Those, the peace offerings typically, would be sacrificed and placed on the altar, slain, placed on the altar, and then portions of those animals are burned completely on the fire, and that represents that which is given to God. And then other portions are eaten by the people. So there will be a large, there'll be a big feast that will follow this, and the people will be eating the meat of those offerings. As the animals are killed, they're killed by slitting their throats typically, the blood is captured. And he takes from all of these animals that are sacrificed. And Moses takes half of that blood and puts that in basins, and we'll see later what happens to that. The other half he sprinkles on the altar, sprinkled against the wall of the altar. Then he takes the book that he had written, and he reads all of the contents of that, so that means he reads to all of the people of Israel the last, whatever it is, four chapters that we've gone through. And the people say, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do and we will be obedient. So that is the third time that the people have agreed to do whatever God asked. The first time they didn't know what God was asking. They agreed to do whatever God said, but they didn't know what the stipulations were. The second two times, they have heard what God's requirements are specifically, and they have agreed to those terms. Then Moses takes the other half of the blood, and he sprinkles it on the people of Israel. One commentator suggested that he splashed it against the 12 pillars. That's a sanitized version. I'm not sure whether that's what happened or not. Sarna says, with respect to this, to the sprinkling here, he says, the significance of the sprinkling of the blood is never explained. However, the prevailing notion in Israel was that the blood, the vital bodily fluid, constituted the life force. As such, like life itself, it belonged to God alone. For that reason, its consumption by humans is strictly forbidden. And the blood of sacrifices is dashed on the altar. The use of blood in a covenant is found nowhere else in the Bible. The ordination of Aaron as high priest, as related in Leviticus 8, involved daubing the blood of the sacrificial lamb of ordination on parts of his body and on the altar. It is likely that in both these ceremonies, covenant and ordination, the blood functions mysteriously to cement the bond between the involved parties. Through God's sharing, as it were, of the vital fluid with Israel and with Aaron, the life of the recipient is thought to take on a new dimension and to be elevated to a higher level of intimate relationship with the deity. In any case, it's with this ceremony then that the agreement is sealed. So this is like when you buy a house and you go and sign the papers. That's when the deal is finalized. Everything before that is negotiation. There's nothing legally binding about what happens before that. But once the papers are signed, then it's legally binding. Similarly, Everything that's been talked about up to this is negotiation. But now we have a binding agreement. Verses 9 through 11. Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the Lord, the God of Israel. And under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And they beheld God, and they ate and drank. So Moses, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and the 70 elders, they've gone up. Apparently it's just up, partway up on the mountain. And that group of people, they share this meal with God. And to share a meal with someone in the Near East, and to a certain extent even today, suggests a relationship of friendship with the person that you're sharing a meal with. Moses and these others, it says, they saw the God of Israel. There are a few times in the Bible where it talks about people seeing the God of Israel. Generally, the perspective is you don't want to see God. That's a dangerous thing to do. And as we've talked about, these are all people who have seen displays of God's power. They've seen what he can do, and they have reason to take him seriously. But they saw God. Curiously, in the passage, there is absolutely nothing said about what God looked like, which is, I've noticed there are other visions and dreams where God appears, and it is typical that there is no description of what God looks like. I can think of one exception to that. All it describes is the things around God. And here, it's what's under his feet that's described. And that is a pavement that looks like sapphire. I suspect, by reading it, you get the suspicion that they don't even want to look at God. That's too scary. That's too much to do. So they're just looking up at his feet, and they see the pavement. And then verse 11, it says, yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel, and they beheld God, and they ate and drank. So they've seen God and lived. They've been in his presence and lived. And that's an amazing thing. So they eat this meal there, and that is the conclusion of this deal. They've signed the papers, and now they've celebrated the signing of those papers. The next section. Now the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction. So Moses arose with Joshua his servant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. But to the elders he said, wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them. Then Moses went up to the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain, and the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. And to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. And Moses entered the midst of the cloud as he went up to the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So, after they've eaten the meal, God speaks, and he tells Moses, come on up. But everybody else stay back. The elders, Aaron and his sons are told to stay where they are. And God says that he's going to give to Moses a stone tablet with the law and the commandments which I have written for their instruction. So God has written on a stone tablet the Ten Commandments. It becomes later clear later in Exodus that that's what was written on the tablets. So God has written these on tablets. He's going to give them to Moses for their reflection, for their instruction. So Moses goes up. He takes only one person, Joshua, further with him. But he only takes Joshua partway up. The elders, he says, you wait here. So they apparently turn around and go back. Moses seems to know that he's going to be up on the mountain for a period of time, because he says, if there are any problems, any legal problems that develop, anything that needs to be adjudicated, Aaron and Hur can do that. So he's anticipating being gone for some time. Moses then proceeds on, and he enters into the cloud. Presumably Joshua doesn't enter into the cloud. Joshua goes up partway on the mountain, but then it's only Moses that goes into the cloud. And he's there for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, God calls to Moses, and Moses goes up into the middle of the cloud, up to the top of the mountain. Now, I don't know if they took food with them. They're up there for a long time, both Moses and Joshua. I don't know if they took food with them. I don't know if God provided food. I don't know what the circumstances are there. But that's a long time. He's there 6 days before he even enters into the cloud. But on the seventh day, God calls to him, and he goes up. Now, from the people below looking up at this scene, it says in 17, and to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. So there's a cloud, but apparently that cloud just looks like a burning fire. It's glowing while Moses is up there. And Moses is up there for 40 days and for 40 nights. So the deal has been sealed. The deal between God and the people of Israel has been finalized. The people have agreed to the terms. God had listed all those terms out. They'd heard them. They agreed to them. And they have conducted a ceremony which concludes that deal. So that's the end of this section. It's going to go on in chapter 25 and then proceeding. God is going to give to Moses, while Moses is on the mountain, he's going to give him instructions as to how the tabernacle, God's tabernacle, is to be constructed. Then there will be a little historical interlude for two or three chapters. And then the last six or seven chapters of the book of Exodus are the construction of that tabernacle. So, the description of this tabernacle, both the planning and then the construction of it, take up 13 chapters of the book of Exodus. That's a fairly large chunk. The next time I teach, I'm going to start in on the tabernacle. And my assumption going into it is that whatever's going on, this is a fairly important thing. That there would be that much text devoted to that topic seems to me to give it a certain amount of gravitas. So that's what I'm going to be working on over the next few months to try to figure out and prepare for. There is one other thing that I want to talk about before we finish, and that is I want to talk about the seven feasts of Israel. These are the official feasts. These are the ones that God says you are to celebrate every year, and you are to, wherever you are, you're to come to Jerusalem. This is later on, not at this time, but later on. You're to come to Jerusalem to celebrate those seven feasts. I think, it is my working hypothesis, that the seven feasts all map on to events in Exodus. It was my daughter that first suggested that. And she was looking at the feasts and studying them, and she said, you know, I think that for each feast there is an event in Exodus. And when she first told me that, and I was looking at Exodus and trying to do the matching, I just couldn't see it. But I've been changing my mind. I really think that she's right. Earlier, when I first began, I said that Sarna agreed, that he also thought the same thing. But I looked back at his statement, and it's not clear exactly whether he agrees with that or not. What he says is that one of the important reasons for studying the Exodus is because it gives you the background to the feasts. But it's not clear whether he means the background to all of the feasts or if he's talking about some of the feasts. And the reason I wonder whether it's some of the feasts is as he goes through the book of Exodus, he doesn't correlate the other feasts with things in Exodus. So I'm not sure whether he would agree on this point or not. But I think he'll come around. In any case, this is my working hypothesis, and it is a little dicey. There were seven feasts. There was a cluster of three feasts in the spring, one feast in the early summer, and another cluster of three feasts in the fall. These are all laid out in Leviticus chapter 23. I won't read through that, but you could look at that. The religious year, as we know, we saw earlier in Exodus, the religious year is supposed to start in the spring. And Passover, the first of the feasts, comes on the 14th day of the first month. And that is celebrating the event of the Passover as they left Egypt. The second feast is the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which begins the day after Passover, and it goes for 7 days. And that's a period of time when they eat only unleavened bread in recognition of how quickly they had to get out of Egypt and be on the run. The third feast is the Feast of First Fruits. And that happens, and it's not exactly clear to me, but it seems to happen the third day after Passover. And that's when it's a time of giving thanks to God for the first harvest, the first harvest, I think, is the harvest of barley, and to celebrate God's provision. So that's the cluster of the spring feasts. 7 weeks later is Pentecost, or Shavuot. And that is we'll talk about that later. What is that? It is a time when they celebrate the harvest of wheat, but I'll come back to the question of whether it has any other significance. The fall feasts begin in our month of September. The first of those holidays is the Feast of Trumpets. It's not clear what that celebrates. That has become Rosh Hashanah, so the beginning of the year. But that's the beginning of the calendar year, not the religious year. The religious year begins 2 weeks before Passover. The second of the fall feasts is the Day of Atonement, where the people of Israel fast all day long and pray for and repent. Pray to God in repentance. And the last of the fall feasts is the Feast of the Tabernacle, or Sukkot, and that begins on the 15th day of the seventh month, and that goes for a whole week, in which they build a sukkah, a little hut, and they eat their meals in that hut, and they celebrate that whole week. If you're in Israel during Sukkot, there's music and dancing in the streets until late at night. And my son Noah told us a story. He was out watching a group of men dancing, and one of them came and grabbed him and said, "Come and join us." And Noah's quite the dancer, so he jumped in. But the guy who came and got him said, "Yeah, you got to come. It's a mitzvah. It's commanded to be joyous. So you have to come and dance." Okay, so those are the seven feasts. Now, what's tricky about this? Well, first of all, I find it interesting that all three time periods, when there are feasts, have an element of agrarian celebration in them. So in the spring, it's first fruits, so that's the barley harvest. Shavuot is part of the celebration of Shavuot is taking the first part of the wheat harvest and making an offering to God of that. And then the celebration in the fall is the celebration of ingathering, that is the harvest of everything else. So that's when the vineyards are harvested, that's when olives are collected, it's everything else that's harvested at the end of the agricultural year. So all three of these times of festival in ancient Israel correspond to agricultural celebrations, and those agricultural celebrations were conducted throughout the ancient Near East. So those would not have been unique to Israel. But with each of these, it would appear to me that God has built other significance. He's taken the agricultural ceremony as kind of the starting point, and then he develops each of those in different directions as time goes on. And it appears to me that the celebrations did indeed develop over time. Now, mapping these festivals onto the events of Egypt is difficult for two main reasons. The first reason is that the significance of these seven feasts is not made clear in the biblical text. It is often difficult to figure out what is this supposed to celebrate. The obvious exception to that is Passover. Now, that's clear. The Bible makes it very clear that the celebration of Passover is connected with the event that occurred as the people were getting ready to leave Egypt. But the others, it's a little less clear as to what those are all about. Let me give you one example of the lack of clarity that exists. With respect to the Feast of Trumpets in Leviticus 23, I'll I'll read what it says. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, okay. Leviticus 23:24, talking about this this festival. It says, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first of the month, you shall have a rest, a reminder by blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work, but you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord." So this is a reminder by blowing of the trumpet. A reminder of what? So these festivals, it is not made clear what some of them are all about. If you're trying to figure out what is this a reminder of, well, how do we know? How can we possibly know if it doesn't tell us? Now, it's possible that at the time, they all knew. At the time of Moses, they all knew what they were being reminded of. But we don't know if that's been passed down to us, and we have no resources by which to recover that unless there are clues within the biblical text. And if there are clues within the biblical text, if it's a reminder of something that preceded this, if it's an event, maybe it's not an event, maybe it's a reminder of some quality of God or whatever. But if it's an event, you would think that there would be some kind of clue in the text. And I think there is. That's part of what I've been working on. Another thing that makes the significance of the feasts unclear, besides the fact that the Bible doesn't make it clear, is that if you look at the way that these feasts are practiced in the tradition of Judaism, oftentimes there are various aspects to each celebration. There are different things that are all brought together in one celebration, and it's hard to figure out what in essence is this festival about. It's got a little bit of this, it's got a little bit of that, it's got a little bit of this. So what in essence is this festival? And that can be very difficult to sort out. Take something like, well, let's take the festival, the Feast of Trumpets. That's become Rosh Hashanah. Now that's celebrated more as the beginning of the new year than it is anything having to do with trumpets. However, there is in the practice of some of these festivals some intriguing elements that could be helpful in figuring out what was intended with these feasts. In my notes, if you've got my notes, you're looking at them, I think the Feast of Trumpets became a celebration of the law. That's wrong. It's Shavuot became a celebration of the law. So Pentecost becomes associated with a celebration of the law that God gave to Moses, and it is read on Shavuot. And we know that that practice became associated with Shavuot early on, certainly before the time of Christ. But we don't know when exactly that association was made. It could go back much further than that, but I don't know. Okay, so those are the two problems with trying to figure out the significance of the feasts. One is the Bible doesn't give us much information, and secondly, the practices in Judaism are all over the map. There are all kinds of things that are brought in into the celebration of various feasts. A second kind of problem, as we're trying to map these onto events in the Exodus, is if the feasts are happening in such a way that they commemorate some event in Exodus, and it's in chronological order, it would be nice to have chronology in Exodus. Passover is celebrated on the day when the Passover happened in Egypt. Are other events in Egypt, do they correlate with the festivals, the dates of the festivals? Well, that's difficult to determine because we don't have good chronological information in Exodus to determine exactly when the various events in Exodus took place. But if we, just looking at the first four feasts and attempting to map those onto events in Exodus, the Passover, the Feast of the Passover, that is celebrated on the day when the Passover, the original Passover took place in Egypt. The Feast of Unleavened Bread starts the day after Passover and goes for 7 days. That end of 7 days puts us approximately at the date when they would have been at Marah, where the water was turned from bitter to sweet. The date of the first fruits, the festival of the first fruits, it's apparently 3 days into their, it's 3 days after Passover, and 3 days after Passover, if every time that it says that they camped indicates the end of 1 day, then that puts them at the Red Sea. At the opening of the Red Sea would correlate with the Festival of First Fruits. Shavuot or Pentecost. It's hard to determine exactly when what happened on that date in Exodus, but they arrive at Mount Sinai at the beginning of that month. Pentecost would be the 7th week. So we don't have all the days numbered out in Exodus, but that is approximately when the law was given by God to the people of Israel that Pentecost would correlate to. It's within a day or two of that, in all likelihood. Then, as we proceed in Exodus, establishing the dates of events becomes more difficult. But I think, my suspicion is, that the Feast of Trumpets best correlates, and I'm going on content more than dates because the date is hard to establish. But I think that the Festival of Trumpets probably correlates with what happened after they built the golden calf, and Joshua and Moses are coming down from the mountain. And Joshua says, this is Exodus 32, verse 17. He says, "There is a sound of war in the camp." But he said, "It is not the sound of the cry of triumph, nor is it the sound of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing I hear." My suspicion is that it probably correlates to that. It's God coming to judge. Then Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, probably corresponds to the event that happens soon. Oh, and I should point out, one of the practices of the Festival of Trumpets in modern-day Judaism is the beginning of reflecting on your own sinfulness. It begins on the Feast of Trumpets, and it continues through the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. Then I think the Day of Atonement then would map onto God choosing not to destroy Israel because Moses interceded on their behalf. And then the Sukkot, the Feast of the Tabernacles, I'm not sure where to put that, but it's got to relate to the building of the tabernacle. It's got to have something to do with that. And it could be when God descended and dwelt in the tabernacle. So that's my working hypothesis. It makes sense to me. It appeals to me for a number of reasons. But one is, as I've mentioned before, if that's what God has done, if that's the way that God has structured things, then the people of Israel are being asked to relive the Exodus, the book of Exodus, in their religious life every year. And I will point out that from the time of the Passover to the end of the book of Exodus is exactly 1 year, as it says right at the end of Exodus. So it would map on to a year very nicely. Okay. The nice thing, if that is the case, then that's really helpful in that it gives a context for these feasts and helps to figure out what these feasts are all about. I think it's fascinating that God would ask them to celebrate these feasts and not make clear what they're celebrating. It's just one more assignment that God has given to his people. Go figure it out. This raises another interesting possibility, and one that I won't take the time to explore, but if the feasts map on to the events of Exodus, we know there's at least one feast that has a correlated event, that is, Passover correlates with the death of Christ, and interestingly, Jesus' death at about 3 PM corresponds exactly to the time when Passover lambs were being sacrificed in the temple. So then the question is, do these feasts map on to other events in salvific history as well as mapping on to events in Exodus? So that's my working hypothesis, and I will that's part of what I will continue to work on in preparation for teaching through the rest of Exodus. But it talked about the holidays here in this section that we just looked at, and I thought that this would be a good time to present that. And we've got Passover coming up, and thought that might be appropriate. Okay. We've got time for questions or comments, and they can be over what I've said today, or they can be over things that I said last week, because there wasn't any time for questions last week.
David, I was surprised when I went back and read this on when Moses and Joshua and the elders went up and had, sounded like a picnic with God. Mm-hmm. And that just sounded so, and then you, because I always thought that stuck in my mind was when Moses went up and there was, the mountain was, looked like it was erupting and the people were fearful and trembling and so it just seems like that's a big contrast between those two events. And so, and I always thought, well, you can't even come close to seeing God or whatever. So mm-hmm. You got a comment on that?
Yes. I think that contrast is intentional. That there's a sense in which God is a terrifying being. And we've seen them afraid of God. God spoke, when he spoke the Ten Commandments to them, that was a scary thing. When the mountain was, there was thunder and there was earthquakes and all that sort of thing, that was a very scary thing. And they've seen him do very powerful things when he released, got them out of Egypt. So on the one hand, God is a very powerful and terrifying being. But on the other hand, he has condescended to make an agreement with them to make them a special people, to make them a holy people, to make them a nation of priests. And their relationship with God is of such a nature that they can sit down and have a meal with him. That's amazing. And I think we're supposed to see that contrast, because it is an amazing contrast. God is being very generous here, very condescending in a good sense. I mean, coming down to their level.
It was a while ago, but when we were in Hebrews, this passage is quoted by Paul.
Which passage?
The part about sprinkling the blood on altar and on the people, and this is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made. And the point that the argument that he makes is that that's where he makes that famous statement, it's like there is no forgiveness of sins without blood. So he associates the sprinkling of the blood with forgiveness.
Forgiveness.
And I think he's getting that from the way blood gets used then in mm-hmm. the temple, mm-hmm. where during propitiatory offerings, the blood is smeared on ears and corners yep. of the altar yep. and various places. So for him, the blood seems to be one way of appealing to God for mercy. Mm-hmm. And the point that he's making is, this is at the inauguration of the covenant. I mean, they haven't even broken the covenant yet, because it hasn't been inaugurated right. yet, and right. yet there's need for propitiation.
Yeah.
And
that's great. The point that he that's has. Great. That's great, yeah. They have shown themselves to be the kind of people that can be expected to break the covenant, but they haven't done it yet, yes.
I don't know if you want to comment on this. We were in Israel during this time at one point, and
during which time?
During Passover and mm-hmm. the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and it became obvious to me how incredibly complicated it is to figure out these feasts and what's being required of them, and the Jewish people want to make sure they get it all right down to the letter of the law, and so it gets kind of bizarre. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, they're supposed to get rid of all of their leaven in their house, and so they start doing that, and they take it out into the streets, and they have these little fires, and they burn all their bread, and but it's hard to get rid of all of your leaven. And so you can go to the market, and there'll be these rabbis there. And you can go to that rabbi, and the rabbi will buy the leaven that is in your house and write that on a piece of paper. And you pay him to do that. And then he gives that to a non-Jew for the feast. After the feast is over, then you can... So any leaven that's in your bread is now not yours. It belongs to somebody else. And so so then after the feast, you get your little paper back. Right. And then it's yours again. And there's so many of those little things. I mean, Noah's describing this morning, you know, is any wheat, let's see, how did he describe it? Is there even legumes, like if they've been in water for a certain amount of time and they start to ferment, then you have yeast that's coming from those, from those. Anyway, it gets super complicated. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting to watch the Jews try to get this just right, because they're trying to follow this law. And I'm not seeing, I mean, maybe that's what's intended. I'm not seeing in these feasts that it was quite supposed to be so complicated.
In interacting with our children who have spent more time in Israel than we have, it has become clear to me that if any of us were asked to follow some of these commandments, that it would take a lot of thought. So, for instance, Sabbath. You can't work on Sabbath. Well, there's the question, what is work? You'd have to ask that question. So to follow these, you're going to have to answer some nitpicky questions. Now, having said that, what I talked about very early on with respect to the law is I think that we should look at the law that God has given not as statutory law, that is, statements that are written out and we are to follow them as they are written, that is, literally, and see them rather as the kind of thing that that instruction and rules given by a parent to children are. That is to say that what God intended was for the people of Israel to reconstruct from all of his commandments and his instructions and everything else his worldview, such that then they could look at any situation and say, well, this is what God would want me to do in this particular situation. The significance of that is there are no loopholes. And in fact, to try to find loopholes is contrary to the whole thing. It's not getting around the wording of the law. It's trying to understand what God actually intended and being obedient to what God intended, to his worldview. So trying to find loopholes makes no sense if that's what God has asked us to do, asked them to do, and us. So it seems to me that's really our task, is to figure out why would God have given these commandments, and how does that inform and help us construct a worldview that's all coherent, makes sense of everything, and then we can use that to look at different circumstances to figure out what God wants us to do. And I think obedience to these laws would look quite different if one took that perspective as opposed to what has typically happened.
Thanks, David. Mm-hmm. Just a detailed question. I remember from Deuteronomy that Moses mentions two times of going up the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. Am I reading this right, that the second time he goes up is when he gets the second set of stone tablets? That's the second 40 days and 40 nights. And the first one is what we're coming up on in chapter 25, the tabernacle details?
I believe so.
Okay.
But that's one of the things, when I talked about the complications of the chronology, it is difficult to know. Well, I won't get into all of it. It's complicated. And then, but I think there are two times he goes up for 40 days and 40 nights each, if those are not symbolic numbers.
Last week, you talked about, I forget what kind of sacrifice it was, but what was required was, I think it was a whole burnt offering in it, and it was the fatty portions or something to do with the fatty portions. And it struck me that there was a kind of a parallel between some of the laws in under Moses and things that happened earlier in Genesis. Like, for example, Abel was commended for giving the fatty portions of his offering. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be a significant expression of his heart.
Right.
Did you see these parallels, and what are they significant, or am I just reading something?
Well, I hadn't thought of that one, and I would have to think about that one, because I think that expression, the fatty portions in Genesis, is using that term in the way that it is used elsewhere in the Old Testament, which means the best part. It's not actually identifying a portion of the body, of the anatomy, but it's saying the best part. And I think here in Exodus, it's actually talking about the fatty portion, but that was understood to be the best part. So in that sense, it correlates. But I think that there's quite a bit of harmony as we go through the Pentateuch, that there are a number of things that hearken back to statements and practices of Genesis. And yeah, that could be part of one. Okay, thanks.